This is Read On Air with Red Zell, for those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week we delve into the world of non-fiction. Psychoanalyst and author Stephen Gross reveals his love of literature.
I always feel that a short story is capturing a moment and trying to tell the truth of that moment.
Professor Mark Miodovnik shares some fascinating insights into the fabric of modern life.
There's hundreds of materials. In each one of them is a sort of answer to a problem or a kind of expression of a dream that we have.
And we take a chilling journey to the roof of the world with John Krakauer's hidden gem, Into Thin Air.
The mountain still holds the master card.
All true stories as compelling as any novel, and all in today's show. It's very rare that I reread a book. From time to time, I might return to something I read years ago, but never within 5 years of first reading it. But there's an exception to every rule, and The Examined Life by Stephen Gross is a title I've found myself repeatedly drawn back to. And I'm not alone. It was on the Sunday Times bestseller list for 10 weeks. It was listed in the Daily Telegraph as one of the top 20 audiobooks and has been translated into more than 15 languages. So I'm genuinely thrilled to welcome its author, Stephen Gross, into the studio today.
I opened the windows in my consulting room a little and then went out to get my last patient of the morning. Lily stood up as soon as she heard me. "It's such a relief to be back here," she said. "I had a crazy time at home." Lily had just returned from a trip to New York to visit her parents with her 9-month-old daughter, Alice. The flight from London had been terrible. After navigating her way through the New York airport with Alice and all of their belongings, she found her mother standing outside on the sidewalk. "She hugged me the way she always does," Lily said. "She closes her eyes and pats my back, as if I have fleas." On my last night, after 3 glasses of wine, I tell my parents that when I get back to London I'm going to send them 1,000 photos of Alice. You have to understand, there are photos in every room of the house. There's a whole flotilla of photos on the grand piano, but nowhere is there a single photo of their first grandchild. And my mum says, "Oh my gosh, didn't you see it? It's my favourite." And she goes into the bedroom, rummages around in the dresser, and pulls out a picture of Alice. She smiles and says, "Oh, I love that picture." Then my dad says, "Oh, I love that picture." And then I say, "Oh, I love it too." But I'm thinking, what the fuck? Does she think I have X-ray eyes? I stifled a laugh. Lily was quiet for a moment.
One of the things that shines through your book, Stephen, is your love of literature. They read like beautifully crafted short stories, and yet they are about real people.
Yeah, I love short stories. I always feel that a short story is capturing a moment and trying to tell the truth of that moment. That's what I wanted to do in my book. The idea was that you could pick up and read the book and read any order, but when you read the book from front to back and read these stories in order, the first stories are more about the beginnings of life, and the last stories are about death and the end of life and various forms of leaving or endings. And I wanted readers to have a kind of sense of that arc or that trajectory from birth to death. It's also about my career, because I've been a practicing psychoanalyst for 30 years now, and I wanted to give a sense of my career from beginning to end as well. So there's that. But I also wanted to give some sense of a journey of discovery, so that almost like an analysis, a personal journey that you might take as a reader, that you would learn new things, and some of the later things will build on things that are in the beginning of the book. There were reasons, I mean, in terms of confidentiality, it's good to write briefly, because you can very much disguise my patients, and that's very important to me, that their privacy is respected, and I could change things but tell the truth of the moment and give a moment from their therapy. But I've also loved short stories. I loved chiefly Chekhov. Whenever I travel or whenever I go anywhere, it's often a volume of his stories. I'll always throw a collection of his stories. Kafka, Bruno Schultz. I love Isaac Babel short stories. Frank O'Connor, Nabokov's another one that I like. Updike short stories, Cheever. One of the things your listeners might enjoy that has been really special to me, it's a kind of education to me, the New Yorker magazine does a fiction podcast with Deborah Treisman, and she gets a short story writer to read one of their favorite short stories from the magazine and then talk to her about their choice. To me, it was an education as a writer, those short stories, about 100 of them now. They're the most fabulous listening experience. The reading is beautiful. Deborah Treisman is the best fiction editors, talking with a fiction writer about a first-rate fiction story. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to listen to.
There's also an element of parable about the stories that you tell. We all experience the same emotions and same tragedies and have to deal with them.
I think one of the things people liked about the book was I took them into the world of what analysts, psychotherapists, counselors think about when they're working with patients. They make mistakes, we make mistakes, we get things wrong. At one point, I point out how just like a good teacher might envy a brilliant student or a good coach, a successful athlete in a way that an analyst will envy a successful patient. Maybe I've helped somebody cure something in their life that I haven't sorted out in my own. We're human, and it's very important to see that. And if only by bringing those aspects in, I think will a reader believe you and accept the truth of what you're saying. You have to be honest, very honest on the page. And I tried to do that. But you're right. And I tried to choose the stories, the 30-some stories in the book. I tried to think, what were the most important things, issues that my friends would want to know about, that my wife would want to know about? People ask me, what are the really essential issues? And then I tried to address those from my clinical notebooks, from the things, my experiences, and my work. So I tried to talk about the things that I thought were most important.
Yes, and of course the full title is The Examined Life, How We Lose and Find Ourselves. And I suppose in some ways what you're trying to do is stop us losing ourselves as a reader, or help us rediscover ourselves through your observations over 25 years.
There are many ways we get separated from ourselves, and we have that feeling of being trapped, that life should be different than it is, or how did we get here, or separated from the things we loved and loved doing. And so I wanted to give a kind of picture of how that those things can happen to us. One of the key themes of the book is the relationship between change and loss. And so many of the stories have to do, people come to me because they want to change and they can't. In the beginning of the preface, I quote a patient of mine who once said, I want to change, but not if it means changing.
Yes.
And we've all felt that, you know, I want to change, but oh my gosh, do I have to really start exercising? And do I really have to go out and do this and this, the things which I know to be true? And a lot of the difficulties that I try to point out is that all change involves loss. If you're going to do a new thing, you have to give up an old way of doing things. And that's very painful for us. Life is, in a sense, a series of necessary losses. From birth, we give up the womb to enter into the world. We give up the breast to have food. We give up our home to start going to nursery school and the comfort of our mother. And leaving home and marriage, too, is giving up our original family to make a new family. I mean, we think they should all be happy, but they do involve letting go of things which we've cherished. And some people find that so difficult to do that they can't do that. So I want to talk about that in the book and try and help people see, you know, that's why sometimes, for example, there's stories in the book about people who have a success and have a breakdown. That's not an uncommon thing. Or achieve something and then become incredibly unhappy with the change, even though they've worked for years to get to a certain place. They can become all of a sudden filled with depression. So I want to understand some of those things and that we see around us, but we can't quite figure out. And I tell stories to try and explain that to readers.
I suppose living in an oral tradition as we do, maybe that's why The Examined Life has translated so well to audiobook because, especially with Peter Marinka's wonderful reading.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
And I believe you had a hand in selecting him to read the book.
We talked about different people, and that experience of listening to different voices and discussing it and, you know, asking him to do it. And we met in a pub before coming over, and we chatted about ourselves. And Peter's father was a doctor in Canada, where he was raised. And we spoke for a while, and he said, "Oh, I know what, I'll do my father's doctor voice." And his voice dropped about an octave, and we had this wonderful, slightly gravelly tone to it, which, you know, was fantastic.
Throughout the visit, neither of Lily's parents showed much interest in her life. They left their two televisions blaring and ate their meals crammed around the kitchen counter. Her father often ate with his laptop propped open next to his plate.
It was an amazing experience listening to it on audiobook because my stories began in conversation. They began through listening and through speaking. And I transferred that onto the page. And the audiobook experience of having them transferred back off the page into a voice was amazing. It was electrifying. And Peter also did the Book of the Week on the radio, BBC. And the first time I heard it, I was just being in my kitchen having a cup of coffee with my wife. And we sat down to listen. And it was electrifying in a way totally I just not expected. It was a wonderful thing, a wonderful experience.
I know you're a very keen listener of listener to audiobooks anyway. So
I've been listening recently to Juliet Stevenson reading the Henry James Portrait of a Lady, which is fantastic. And there's some, you know, that are wonderful. The Elena Ferrante novels, which are so popular right now, I think are beautiful on audiobook. But my favorite book recently that I've read, I've been really moved by the writing of an American writer. Readers and, you know, listeners may not know him. His name is Kent Harouf, and he's from Colorado. He died last year, and he wrote a wonderful trilogy called the Plainsong Trilogy, and that's beautifully read on audiobooks. But the last one is the book I'm enjoying so much right now, and it's a book that I press into people's hands. It's called Our Souls at Night. And it's the story of a 70-year-old man and a 70-year-old woman. And she's a widow. He's a widower. They live in this fictional town he's created through all of his books over his life called Holt, Colorado. And it begins on the first page. This widow visits her neighbor down the road a bit and says, I was wondering if you'd like to sleep with me. And she's saying, not how you might think, but I get a feeling you're lonely at night, and I'm lonely at night, and I was wondering if you'd just like to come over to my house. And anyway, he takes her up and on her offer, and they lie on the bed and hold hands and talk. Now, it's beautiful on the page. It's beautifully written. But the audio book of it is fabulous because it's mostly the conversation of these two people about their life together, you know, their lives with their wives, their children, the raising. And slowly through this conversation, through talking, they fall in love and the relationship deepens. And then it's about the reaction of the world around them. And I don't want to give away what happens and what goes on for the rest of the book. I just read that it's about to be made into a film. So before whatever they're going to do with it, they do to it. It's a beautiful piece of writing and a beautiful audiobook, I think.
Well, thank you. That sounds like a fantastic recommendation. Yeah. And can we expect another book in the near future?
I'm working on a book. Well, the first book was about change and loss. What I'm writing now is about the obstacles to falling and remaining in love, the difficulties of that, and why it's so hard, and what happens, and when we make bonds with other people, and then when we break those bonds of love as well. So that's what I'm working on, Red.
Stephen Gross, thank you very much for coming into the studio.
Thanks,
and
Red.
Sharing your love of reading with our listeners. Stephen's book was narrated by Peter Marinka. His reading of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Beautiful and Damned is Talking Book 17512. Or you could try Frederick Forsyth's The Phantom of Manhattan, Talking Book 15009. If you're a believer in the old adage, truth is stranger than fiction, and have a non-fiction book to recommend, drop an email to us. The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is Read On Air.
Welcome back. I'm Red Sale. Today we're exploring the non-fiction shelves, and at the Glasgow Studios, Robert Kirkwood talked to John Aitchison, a double BAFTA and Emmy Award winner for his work, both as a nature documentary producer and as a cameraman. His book, The Shark and the Albatross, tells the stories that don't make it to the screen.
Through the lens, I can see her whiskers, covered in frost, and her amber eyes. She turns to look directly at me. It's the first eye contact I've had with any of the wolves.
John Aitchison, reading from his book, in a break in the recording, he told me about the book.
It's about various stories of filming wildlife all over the place. I've been a wildlife cameraman for 20 years, and it struck me that what I have to film is generally wildlife behaviour. So I might go somewhere to film a tiger and her cubs, and she's hunting to feed the cubs, and it's a story about maybe how stealthy she is and how the prey avoid her catching them. But in each of these places, there's much more to tell than just that one story which appears on the television. Because in the background, there are fascinating people who work there and live there and know the tigers very well. And there's a story of what the filming is like, what the experience is like behind the scenes. And also the conservation story, because in that case, for instance, the tiger's forest is surrounded by farms. The tigers don't have anywhere else to go, so the cubs most often die. They're either killed by male tigers if they stay behind, or if they go outside, they tend to be killed by people or hit by trains. Those stories were, if you like, going to waste, and it seemed to me there's another level of interest in natural history beyond just pure wildlife behaviour.
The shots that inspired the title of the book, the incident with the shark and the albatross, did you know that was likely to happen, or was it an accident?
No, we went there specifically for that purpose. It had been filmed once before, and it happens every year. There's a small island, lots of albatrosses nesting on it. They have to leave, and they haven't flown before. So their very first flight takes them out over the water. And if they're strong and have been able to practice in windy conditions on the island, if they've been able to fly up and down vertically, they might get far enough away that they escape the sharks. But these tiger sharks swim maybe 1,000 miles to be at that one island for the 2 or 3 weeks when the albatrosses leave every single year. And they arrive usually on the first day that the albatrosses start flying. And no one knows how they do that. But they wait just offshore. The albatrosses try and take off, get clear of the sharks, which they don't know about, of course. And the sharks grab them if they land above them. They have some way of detecting them by electrical impulses too, I think. I don't think they just see them. And they take the albatrosses from below, drag them underwater and eat them. So I was supposed to film that from above, and there were divers there filming it from underneath as well, filming the sharks. Now, what struck me was that I sympathised with the albatrosses, which I guess is understandable, because I was looking at them all the time, and from their perspective, the sharks are a nightmare, really. They just appear from nowhere and swallow the albatrosses. Whereas the divers who were with the sharks would come up every time saying, how wonderful the sharks were. They were taking great risk diving with these big sharks, but they were saying they were beautiful, and they were saying how incredible they were that they'd migrated so far. And they were saying that they're overfished and they're dying out because so many are caught each year. Meanwhile, on the islands, the albatrosses, we were finding young albatrosses choked on plastic rubbish, which they'd been fed by their parents by mistake, thinking it was food. So I chose that title for the book, The Shark and the Albatross, because it struck me that when we think about predators and prey, we might be thinking that we prefer one over the other, shark or albatross. But in fact, now, there's so many pressures on nature that we should be thinking whether we want sharks and albatrosses or neither. Because at the present, we're heading towards a state where there might be neither. We have to decide if we're on nature's side or against nature. So that book is, my book is about that partly as well.
Now, when you said there that you sympathised with the albatross, it reminded me of a documentary called Faces in the Mob about kangaroos, and one scene in particular featuring the last slow moments of a joey. Is that ever a dilemma? Would part of you want to rescue that creature, or would you rather document nature taking its course?
It's a dilemma, actually, always. Every situation is different in that respect. The simplest thing would be a predator and its prey. Unless I've somehow caused the prey to be in the path of the predator, which I would always try and avoid doing, obviously, then I feel I should have no part in that, and that the predator has to eat. They'll die, perhaps, if they don't eat the thing that they would normally eat. So that's just a watch and see, and I might have to wince and sometimes even turn away when that's happening, because sometimes it can be quite horrible. But if it's something, a young animal maybe that's suffering or that's abandoned or stuck in some way, it's fallen in a hole or it just needs to be turned over or something like that, it's just an accident, then yes, I will often help. For instance, on the Hebrides series that I made for BBC Scotland with a colleague, when we were filming the short-eared owls nesting, their chicks were exposed to bad weather because the parents had abandoned them. The father went first. He may have actually been killed by a car. We don't really know. And then the mother couldn't feed them and look after them, so she also left. And because I was filming them, I knew that they were on their own in the nest and were getting cold and wet and had no food. And the SSPCA came at my request and took them into care and reared them and then let them go again when they were adult. So, yes, I help sometimes.
What's the longest you've ever waited for a shot?
For one shot?
Hmm.
Well, I suppose it's usually in the order of several weeks. I mean, there've been occasions, there's one in the book actually about filming lynx, where we went for a month, 4 weeks, to Canada and failed to film a sequence of lynx. I did actually film some shots of them, but on their own there were not enough shots to make the story. So although the story could have been changed into a story about snowshoe hares and a little bit about lynx, it just wasn't interesting enough like that. So that was a month without filming the useful shots that we needed.
And what about a favourite moment?
I suppose it might sound strange, but the thing I most like filming are patterns. And that can be patterns of large numbers of animals or natural patterns in the landscape. So some of my favourite things have been big flocks of birds like starlings, those amazing manoeuvres that the murmurations of starlings do just before they go into a roost. And I once filmed that with Bill Oddie, actually, for one of his programmes in Gloucestershire. And he did a very sensitive piece to camera at the same time. Somebody else was filming him talking about the starlings. And the combination, actually, the way it worked out, the combination of the starlings, we were on a slight hill, so the level was particularly good for filming them swirling. They were behind him, so I could see him reacting to them. And the other camera was filming him talking about them very beautifully. And then at the end, there's almost a perfect end to that display because they spiral down into the roost in the reed bed that they go into. And it just naturally ends. It's got a perfect theatrical end to it, just at sunset. So that was a real joy filming that, actually.
And is it better filming? Is it a better job when you're comfortable rather than, say, in Frozen Planet when you're also against the elements?
Yeah, sometimes it can be quite uncomfortable sometimes if it's very cold, but I've got lots of good equipment. The coldest I've been actually wasn't in the Antarctic at all, or the Arctic. It was in the mountains in the Adirondacks in upstate New York earlier this year, because they had an exceptionally cold winter. and I was supposed to be filming pine martens from a hide. And I had 30 days in a canvas hide at minus 30, minus 35 centigrade for 8 hours sitting still. And my water bottle would freeze, and my, you know, the food was all frozen. You're trying to eat frozen apples or frozen sandwiches. And the pine martens were much more sensible. They just didn't come out. I could actually have just left a thermometer there and in front of a webcam or something and gone away to the Caribbean for 3 weeks and come back, you know, after that, and it would have been fine.
Have you ever feared for your life?
Yes, sometimes, but it tends to be more people than animals, really, that are the cause sometimes. And I've never been seriously threatened. It's just sometimes the situations, you get into some strange situations sometimes which are quite remote or where it's not clear really what people's intentions are. Or on roads as well, driving in some countries, it's a bit wild. But I was nearly hit by an avalanche once, quite a small avalanche, but it would have, if I'd been 3 feet to the right, it would have probably swept me off a cliff. I had a snake in a tree. I was filming harpy eagles, which are very big, powerful eagles that live in South America. And that meant staying up in a tree for a month on a tea tray attached to a tree trunk, really, effectively, for all the daylight hours. And it was very, very windy there and stormy quite often. And during a storm with really strong winds, I looked up and there was a very large snake going through the tree next to me. And it did all the branches except the branch I was sitting on. And I realised afterwards that must have meant that it had actually been on that branch. I just didn't notice it, which meant it went over my feet, more or less.
But you keep going back, so you must love it.
Yes, I do love it. Yeah, I'm extraordinarily lucky.
The shark is shocking when it comes. The sea erupts. A head 4 times wider than the bird hurls it towards the sky, its wings trailing. In this liquid world, the shark is astonishingly solid, the antithesis of water, like a blade. Its eyes are blank white circles, zombie-like membranes closed for protection as it attacks. But they mean the shark must strike blind, and it doesn't see the albatross slide sideways from its enormous head, unharmed. A triangular fin cuts past, inches away, and far taller than the bird. The tail thrashes as the shark turns to try again. The camera runs. I haven't breathed.
John Aitchison's book, The Shark and the Albatross, is available in print now in an accessible Kindle version and an audio read by John himself. And John, thank you so much for joining me today on Insight Radio.
Thank you very much.
The Shark and the Albatross is available commercially as an audiobook, but if enough of us request it from the Talking Books Library, who knows, it might be coming to Overdrive soon. I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Miodovnik, Professor of Material Science at UCL and co-founder of the wonderfully named Institute of Making, which is dedicated to improving our understanding of the elements and compounds we've built into our modern lives. His regular appearances on TV and radio have helped make him one of our best-known science communicators. His prize-winning book, Stuff Matters, is a collection of strange stories of marvellous materials that shape our man-made world. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
And for those who haven't read Stuff Matters, it starts off by telling us how a violent incident when you were a schoolboy sparked your interest in material science.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I got stabbed as a teenager on a station, Hammersmith Station in London. At the time, it was obviously stupid of me to get myself into that situation, but it had an upside, I think, in the end. But I know only too well how easy it is to get stabbed, and London is still full of people who get stabbed, so nothing's changed in that sense.
But many people sitting in that police station, rather than looking at the sharp staples pushed through the incident report that the police had made, wouldn't think, oh, why does that stainless steel have the power to cut through paper? Why did the razor blade that was brandished at you cut through several layers of clothing? And how can I expand my understanding of it?
I think as a teenager, you are full of questions, aren't you? And I suppose I didn't really want to think about my actions. It probably was just about distraction, wasn't it? About the pain and the embarrassment that I'd caused. You know, I mean, you sort of feel embarrassed to be stabbed. I know that sounds weird, but I mean, when you, but you kind of think, oh man, I was so stupid to get into that situation. So maybe I was just sort of trying to kind of focus on other things, like how do you make a really sharp razor blade?
Well, clearly you made lemons into lemonade by building a career out of studying materials. Stuff Matters is a fascinating collection of insights into the materials that make up the world around us. Do you have a favourite material?
The truth is that I regard materials like you would regard your kids. You know, you don't really have favourites. They occasionally do something so amazing you just can't believe it. But in general, you just feel love for them all, don't you? And I think that's how I feel about materials.
And I suppose when you and I were children, silicon was the wonder material of the future, and certainly it's gone a long way to growing the world around us. Do you see a new silicon on the horizon? What's going to be the material, do you think, that's going to shape our world in the next couple of decades?
It's very hard to predict how things will pan out. I mean, there are a lot of materials that look interesting at the moment, graphene being one of them, sort of wonder material in the same kind of category of silicon, and that has amazing properties. As we look forward, probably the material change I feel most confident about is the fact that we will live in a more and more diverse and materially rich society, because it's that material richness that is an expression of our feelings about ourselves. So, I mean, the thesis of the book is really that this world around us that we've made is a reflection of us. It's an outward manifestation of who we are internally. So it starts off being about, you know, a desperate need for shelter and for security, buildings, architecture, tools. You know, it's about kind of taking control of a wild planet that will dispense with us at the age of 10, 20, 30 years old. You know, life expectancy was tiny, a storm would come in and we'd just wipe everyone out, or water would get infected and everyone would die. And so sort of getting control of water, getting control of, you know, shelter, food, this was the early materials. Like, this is why the ages of civilization were named after materials like copper, the Copper Age, you know, the Iron Age. You know, these are really important moments. But then as we've kind of come into the modern world, look around us and there's hundreds of materials. In each one of them is a sort of answer to a problem or a kind of expression of a dream that we have. So we want to fly. You know, that's been a long-held dream of humans. And aluminium came along and kind of made it happen for us, you know. And my prediction about the future is that is going to continue, because that is who we are. We make materials that express what we desire.
Yes, I suppose we are also very good at designing specific solutions to specific problems. And as our understanding of the materials around us expands, we can bend those materials more and more to solve those problems.
Yeah, I mean, what's clear from the science is that what people might regard as magical properties or impossibilities, like being able to get to the moon or being able to communicate with someone instantly across the world, those things have turned out to be possible, and it's because we got the right materials. It's almost always a materials problem. These feats of impossibility that we've managed to achieve are materials, are made possible by materials. And there's a huge confidence, I suppose, in the scientific community, and I think it's all shared by society, that kind of anything is possible. We can go to Mars and live in Mars if we want to. If we want it enough, it's not impossible, you know?
And the flip side to that is that I love the fact that you are so keen on promoting the beauty of materials, the aesthetics of materials as well, that in the chapter Paper, where you say paper will be much missed if it does disappear from our world, you also talk about its flexibility, its beauty, its use in origami and love letters, which we shouldn't lose sight of just because it can be superseded by electronic paper.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the aesthetic properties of materials are no less important than the functional properties, obviously, because we are sensual beings, you know, so we like to touch things, we like to smell them, we like to hear them, see them, all these things, and material properties are what give you that sensuality. And we've always had this kind of symbiotic relationship with our environment. We make our environment to kind of express ourselves and what we love and how we love and what we feel. So the silkiness of fabrics, or in fact, even just something as simple as these days we're very used to comfortable chairs, you know. Like chairs of the past were stone and wood and then metal, and all of them very functional but incredibly uncomfortable.
Yes.
And then cushions evolved, you know, with horsehair and wool. But now we have these foam rubbers which are incredibly comfortable, and they've kind of relieved the pressure on our bums collectively. And it's an amazing thing. But that ability to kind of, yeah, just to feel that the world is absorbing your weight and taking it. Oh, that is a sensual feeling that's important.
Absolutely. And as a book lover, even though I find them impossible to read anymore in their physical paper form, I still keep my old collection of paperbacks and hardbacks just for being able to run my fingers down their spine, being able to smell that lovely sort of slightly decaying paper smell that fills libraries.
I do talk about the fact that actually if you wrap something up in paper, it turns it into something completely different. It's the simple act of just wrapping something in a thin layer of paper makes something from an object into a present. And that is, you know, that is so deceptively simple, but it is so important, you know. And then when you give it to someone and they open it, that opening becomes a new life for the object in their hands. And even if it's not a new object, it's new for them at that point. It's a kind of ceremonial and also very aesthetic moment, because paper itself has this kind of, it's actually hard and strong enough to withstand, you know, the process of sending it to someone. But then it's soft and weak enough to be ripped open by a toddler. I mean, what an amazing material.
Was it important for you, as somebody who writes love letters to the materials that you clearly adore and which give you a frisson of excitement, was it important for you to put that down on paper and create a book, hopefully living monument to that love?
I also love the feeling of books, and I think that it's a great privilege to be able to kind of get a book published, because when it's on the screen or in your head, it's somehow very ephemeral. It feels like it's a dream, perhaps some dreamlike, and then it becomes a book, and there's a reality, there's a kind of solidity and an authority that book form gives it, and it's thousands of years of us using that material for that purpose that you're tapping into. So, I mean, I suppose that's another point about materials, is that they have cultural and societal baggage that goes with them. That can be negative and it can be positive, and it's impossible to avoid. So that's why materials are so interesting, because they're sort of culturally, societally unique, as well as having physical, electrical, magnetic, sensual, aesthetic properties. And that's for each material. Paper, steel, aluminium, foam rubber,
yes.
You know. It just goes on, you know, they all have them.
And I understand that you're working on another book at the moment.
It's about liquids. It's the prequel.
Right.
In a kind of simplistic sense of the word, like, you know, essentially liquids tend to come before solids. They often turn into solids, don't they? Materials, we think of materials as essentially solid things.
Yes.
I wanted to write about liquids because we have a very different relationship with them. They also have these kind of culturally interesting set of associations that we hold, but they are kind of alien as well. And I think it's the alienness of liquids juxtaposed to the kind of familiarity of solids that I want to kind of bring out. Acids, you know, acids burn you. Alkalis also burn you. Like water drowns you. You know, mercury poisons you. They're dangerous, and not just that, but they never settle into a form. You can't leave them in a form. That is the nature of liquids. You might put them in a container, but then if you tip the container, they will change shape. And if the container's not stopped, they will pour onto the floor, and they will flow, and they'll get somewhere. They'll go somewhere. They don't care about us. You know, unlike materials where we can leave our cultural imprint on them, or our physical can write a love letter on them, it will remain for a long time. Liquids refuse to cooperate. They are something completely different. So I'm trying to get at that. What is it about liquids that is so kind of slippery?
The shapeshifters of the scientific world,
yeah.
I suppose.
That, yeah.
And we're lucky enough to have Stuff Matters available as an R&IB talking book.
Stuff Matters. The strange stories of the marvellous materials that shape our man-made world. As I stood on a train, bleeding from what would later be classified as a 13-centimetre stab wound, I wondered what to do. It was May 1985, and I had just jumped onto a London tube train as the door closed, shutting out my attacker, but not before he had slashed my back. The wound stung like a very bad paper cut, and I had no idea how serious it was. But being a British schoolboy at the time, embarrassment overcame any sort of common sense. So, instead of getting help, I decided the best thing would be to sit down and go home. And so, bizarrely, that is what I did.
Now, we have a section on Read On Air where I like to ask authors for the books of their lives, typically three books that have influenced them in some way, typically something from childhood or adolescence that made you want to become a writer, a book that you would love to return to on a rainy day when you've got nothing else to do, and something that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend.
I think the book that got me most hooked as a kid was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I mean, it's also a dangerous book, really, I think, for anyone. I mean, because it's so funny. It's a science fiction book, but because it's funny, it somehow transcends the genre of science fiction. It's addictive. The problem is if you try and kind of emulate it, you'll always fall short, and I think that's the problem with having favourite books sometimes, is that you think, oh, I'd like to do something as good as that, and then, of course, that is just the surefire way of not doing anything good at all. But it is a great book.
Ford handed the book to Arthur. "What is it?" asked Arthur. "The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's a sort of electronic book. It tells you everything you need to know about anything. That's its job." Arthur turned it nervously in his hands. "I like the cover," he said. "Don't panic. It's the first helpful or intelligible thing anybody's said to me all day." "I'll show you how it works," said Ford. He snatched it from Arthur, who was still holding it as if it was a 2-week dead lark, and pulled it out of its cover. "You press this button here, you see, and the screen lights up, giving you the index." A screen about 3 inches by 4 lit up, and characters began to flicker across the surface. "You want to know about Vogon, so I enter that name, so." His fingers tapped some more keys. "And there we are." The words Vogon Constructor Fleets flared in green across the screen. Ford pressed a large red button at the bottom of the screen, and words began to undulate across it. At the same time, the book began to speak the entry as well, in a still, quiet, measured voice. This is what the book said. "Vogon Constructor Fleets. Here is what to do if you want to get a lift from a Vogon. Forget it. They are one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy. Not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, officious, and callous. They wouldn't even lift a finger to save their own grandmothers from the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Tral without orders signed in triplicate, sent in, sent back, queried, lost, found, subjected to public inquiry, lost again, and finally buried in soft peat for 3 months and recycled as firelighters."
And then I think books that I kind of got into that took me more down the line of the craft of writing that I could understand, of Primo Levi's books, in particular The Periodic Table, which is actually, you know, another inspiration for Stuff Matters. But this one, I think I felt like I could get the spirit of more. And Primo Levi's an amazing man, or was an amazing man and an amazing writer. And then recently, I guess I'm going to plump for Umberto Eco. I think Umberto Eco is what I really, really love about his writing is that it is sort of makes you think very deeply, but at the same time it's a hugely entertaining sort of romp. So he can write both a fictional, you know, it's like a sort of fictional account of an intellectual thought experiment often. And it appeals to me a lot. You definitely can't go wrong. I mean, if I had a rainy day, I'd read Foucault's Pendulum again, definitely, by Umberto Eco.
Me too, funnily enough. That's exactly what I'd choose. Well, Professor Mark Miodovnik, thank you very much for sharing the books of your life with us and also for coming onto the show and being such a great guest.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And Mark's book, Stuff Matters, is available as talking book number 21932 and is the most accessible science book I've ever read.
Eye health tips for winter. The cold winter months are here, which means wearing layers of clothing to shield exposed skin from the cold. But what about protection for your eyes? The cold air and windy winter conditions can dry out your eyes. Symptoms of dry eyes include a burning or itchy sensation, or the feeling that a foreign object is in your eye. Wearing polarized sunglasses when out in wintry weather will shield your eyes from drying out and also protect against UV rays from snow glare.
This is an RNIB talking book.
The beautiful green countryside of October in California reeled by madly. I was guts and juice again and ready to go.
On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Don't worry about nothing. We're all in this together, yelled Panzo. I saw that was so. Everywhere I went, everybody was in it together.
On the Road swings to the rhythms of 1950s underground America. Jazz, sex and drugs, with Sal Paradise and his hero Dean Moriarty, traveller and mystic, the living epitome of beat.
It was with a great deal of silly relief that these people let us off the car at the corner of 27th and Federal. Our battered suitcases were piled on the sidewalk again. We had longer ways to go, but no matter. The road is life.
Every weekday at 2, with a repeat at 10. Or catch up online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
This is Read On Air.
The deadline for entries to the RNIB writing competition has passed. But if you're as slow a writer as I am, that means a whole year to work on your next submission. In the meantime, let's listen again to Flowers from Crevices by John Ellis, which won a special merit in last year's competition.
Reared in private healthcare, under dietary control, cosseted for life, they bloom and are checked, their pedigree examined, quality under scrutiny. They lie in prescribed life support until cut, ready for a fickle market, which may need them just for a day. Their beauty put on display invites no more than a glance, and soon they will meet their contemporaries, decomposing on a heap as their former fragrance merges with ranker perfume, and dies. The luckier ones, claiming little more than novelty in their provenance, are potted, flaunted and plotted along the imaginary catwalk of a show to preen themselves in the gardens of the rich. They cannot be aware that, in small crevices, sometimes in the pointing of a brick, a real-life struggle goes on, where Obricia, Forget-Me-Not, and even Hollyhock determine to thrive off crumbs and strive, with the blooming of a smile, to show us their true worth.
I'm looking forward to being on the panel of judges again this year. So, best of luck to all the entrants. Recently, I was asked, how do you choose books when you're blind? It's a good question. I used to spend hours in bookshops. I'd browse through covers that caught my eye, read the blurbs, and maybe even flick through a few pages. Nowadays, I'm less adventurous. I stick to recommended titles or authors I've read before. But one of the joys of reading is that a book can take you to new places. And this week's hidden gem took me out of my comfort zone. All the way up Everest, in fact, to the death zone, the area most feared by mountaineers before they get to the summit. Against this backdrop, it tells a story of humanity, both at its weakest and strongest.
On May 10th, I arrived on top of the mountain. But the summit came at a terrible cost.
Into Thin Air is John Krakauer's first-hand account of the 1996 Mount Everest disaster. It claimed the lives of 8 climbers, including 4 members of the expedition that he was on. Now, Krakauer is an American journalist who climbed mountains in his youth. He'd fairly much hung up his harness when he was commissioned to write an article about the commercialization of Everest. Initially, he only intended to go to base camp, but the lure of the mountain reawakened old desires. And the book is a fascinating account of the doomed expedition he joined.
Tendrils of mist were streaming over the 27,923-foot top of Lhotse and lapping at Everest's summit pyramid. No longer did the weather look so benign. I grabbed a fresh oxygen cylinder, jammed it into my regulator, and hurried down into the gathering cloud. Moments after I dropped below the south summit, it began to snow lightly, and visibility went to hell. 400 vertical feet above, where the summit was still washed in bright sunlight under an immaculate cobalt sky, my compadres dallied to memorialize their arrival at the apex of the planet, unfurling flags and snapping photos, using up precious ticks of the clock.
Unlike other mountaineering books, it's not a tale of derring-do. Krakauer's journalistic skepticism gives the book a forensic quality, not unlike an episode of CSI. He probes the motives and actions of all those on the mountainside and seeks to reconstruct how seemingly minor incidents snowballed into catastrophe. It's a compelling story driven by the author's need to understand. This book did not make me want to climb Everest, but I couldn't put it down. Its themes of companionship, self-doubt, and survivor's guilt are universal and all the more compelling for being played out on the highest stage in the world. The book is available as Talking Book number 21065, and other great mountaineering titles available from the RNIB Talking Books Library include Annapurna, South Face by Chris Bonington, TB1646, The White Spider, The Story of the North Face of the Eiger by Heinrich Harrer, TB18839, and Touching the Void by Joe Simpson, TB14234. This next interview is with someone whose books I have loved since I was 7 and whose range of literary accomplishment has meant that her books have stayed with me well into adult life. It is, of course, Lynn Reed Banks. We did have a snippet of her in last week's show when she welcomed me into her kitchen to talk life, love and literature.
When I was a child, I never wanted to be anything but an actress. I never thought of being anything. Yeah, writing was something you kind of did as naturally as breathing. I was always writing something, and I did quite well at writing at school. But all I really cared about was acting, because that was all I was ever thought I would want to be. When I began to fulfil this ambition, studied for the stage, all I wanted to write, if I was going to write, was plays. And I wrote a very large number of plays. Then I began to write a few short stories. Later, short stories were to be quite a sizable part of my income. But basically, I was not really cutting it as an actress. And when my dad died, I really had to get serious because my mother was somewhat rawly left. Then I gradually got into journalism after being a secretary and to a writer, and then I got this wonderful job at ITN.
I understand you were working as one of the first women TV journalists at
the time. TV reporters, yes.
Right. And do you think that influenced your writing of The L-Shaped Room, that you wanted to show that even though these might be soft stories, they had a hard edge to them? But it does have a wonderful documentary feel about it. It did cause quite a scandal amongst a certain
did it?
Sector of...
caused a scandal for my mother, I can tell you that. She said, oh, but this is so real, it's so real. They're all going to think it's real. Of course, I took no notice at all, but she was absolutely right. People think that your first novel is bound to be a thinly veiled slice of life. You're not given the credit for being able to make stuff up. The L-Shaped Room and the next book had been published, and I was publishing short stories and occasional plays also for television. But then when I went to Israel, I was so busy with the teaching, not to mention mucking out chickens and working in the vineyard and the kitchen, But then I wrote Children at the Gate, which was set in Israel, and then I started to write very seriously.
And when you read for pleasure, what do you read? Is it...
Well, it's mainly, I must say, mainly novels. Do you count newspapers? Oh, I've just bought a book. I buy my friends' books. It's called Welcome to Nowhere by Elizabeth Laird. It's about Syria. It's about a current story about Syria and migrants and refugees. And she's a very, very good writer, and she writes about Palestine, and she writes about Lebanon, and all sorts of things which interest me very much, because the Middle East is something that I'm very involved with. Would you like to know my idea of heaven?
Please tell me.
Okay, you're up there, of course, in the clouds. Okay, and you're looking down at the globe. The Earth is turning, in its as is its wont. And as you watch, it's all very dark because you're up in outer space, of course, being in heaven. And every now and then a little light comes on somewhere on the globe, just a little light. And that's somebody reading one of your books. And that's heaven.
That's beautiful.
Don't you think that's the most wonderful idea for an author? That, of course, at some stage or other, the little lights are going to flicker and go out forever. But in the meantime, maybe there are still some people somewhere.
I think the fact that The L-Shaped Room has not been out of print since it was first published
55 years
means that people will be reading it and your other work for a very, very long time to come.
Well, it'd be nice to think so.
Well, thank you for all the pleasure that your books have given me and my family, and I'm sure many of the listeners.
Well, thank you for reading me. That's all I can say.
It's extraordinary to think that her career started as one of Britain's first female TV journalists, a really admirable woman and a great writer. A quick search in the Talking Books library will give you some of her best loved titles to enjoy. So, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and interviewees. And thanks too to everyone who's been in touch about their reading groups, the books you've been enjoying, and those of you who've given me ideas for books to read up on. Next week, as Trainspotting 2 arrives at cinemas across the country, we look at some of the books behind well-known screen adaptations. Remember, if you'd like to get in touch about anything, the address is readonair@rnib.org.uk. Until next week, thanks for listening, and don't forget to read on.